1995, I'm talking to Jim Taft, Colonel Jim Taft, who was the former executive officer of the 384th Bombardment Group in 1940, from the time they got there in June of 43 until what, July of 44?
Left end of June 1944.
End of June 1944. And I want to ask him a few questions about Father Billy. And number one was the time that he had left the base when he had been ordered to be at Smith's office at a particular time and had been giving last rites to somebody at another field or even on our field. I'm not sure about that. And Smith was going to have him court-martialed. Do you know anything about that?
I don't recall that. That could have been after my time. I don't. My only recollection of the trouble with Father Billy, of course, he and Smith were at odds right from the time Smith came, because Smith didn't believe, my recollection was, much in the chaplain's work anyway. And Father Billy, being a Catholic, I think probably made it a little worse. But during the early part of 1944,
yeah.
Before I left, Smith had been shacking up with I believe she was a Red Cross nurse in the area, and it was particularly embarrassing to me because the staff was living fairly close together in a converted Nissen hut there, not too far away from headquarters building, and here this gal was back in Smith's quarters day and night for, it seemed like, days on end. Well, Father Billy apparently made his displeasure known to Smith over this situation, and that made the bad situation even worse. And I think it was shortly after that I left, so I didn't know any further developments on it.
Well, the problem hung on, and evidently until, what was it, September, October? Smith was relieved when? October of 44?
Of 44, because he was still there when I left in June of 44.
He was still there. He was off on his trip to Paris when I left there. And it wasn't long after that that he that he left, and according to his book.
Now, was Billy still there?
Billy was there, yes.
Okay.
He was there long after I left. I know people that flew missions after I flew missions that knew him. And incidentally, was very highly regarded also.
Oh, yes.
The story, when it hit that Smith was being relieved, was, of course, a big relief to everybody on the base.
Yeah.
But the story that he tells in his book, that he was promoted into the Pentagon for planning on the Japanese invasion, which is fine. The other story that I heard over there is that Dolan and Travis at one time had words, and that Travis was a little bit afraid of Dolan because of his World War I experiences and the fact that Dolan is supposedly possibly knew Arnold and who was the other one, the big shot?
Spots or Spots, Acre?
Yeah, not Acre, but the Spots. Mm-hmm. And that Travis couldn't touch him. But
I didn't know anything of that. Pops was such a great fellow that I didn't know that anybody would be mad at him.
Probably had probably the most loved person on
the
base.
That's true.
And he carried that over after the war was over by sending Christmas cards to everybody for years and years and years.
That's right.
I almost believe in my own mind, having known him, not on a first name basis, but if you ever had any problems, you could go to him, or that's Buck, incidentally.
Yeah, Willie
Buck was a quiet
same way
person.
Low-key.
But he did not mince words, nor did he pull his rank.
That's right, yeah.
I loved to fly with him in the lead.
Mm-hmm.
Tom Beckett, to me, was a great gentleman.
Yeah.
I flew with Beckett several times, and never any criticism, never any pushing his rank around.
Let me digress a little to a story about Tom. We were in, we got our training in Sioux City, Iowa Air Base. Tom Beckett, of course, was the air operations officer. And it was determined that when we got our overseas order, there would be a cadre of four senior staff officers would go over ahead of the bomb group and make arrangements on the other side to receive the group. We were to liaise with the Royal Air Force and the headquarters of the 8th Air Force over in England. Tom and I were pretty good friends. Our wives were very close, and our children were close. I'd known Tom in college, actually. We went to go to England. We first went down to Omaha to the municipal airport, and from there we're to fly over to Atlantic City, the staging area, and from then on we would take military air on to England. Well, there was four of us, Pop Dolan, Tom Beckett, myself, and I'm sorry, but I don't even recall the fourth one. I sat with Tom in this United Airlines plane. It was probably a DC-3 at that time. And because of wartime restrictions, they pulled the curtains. Well, Tom was sitting next to the window, and when they pulled the curtains, I could see Tom was a little jumpy. And he literally flew that airplane from Omaha through Chicago to Atlantic City. He said, "This is the first time I've never been up front in a plane."
Is that right?
I don't know whether he was exaggerating, but
no,
the fact that the curtain was closed,
was, yeah,
he felt confined, and he was pulling that stick back.
It probably was.
And worrying about takeoff speed and everything
else. Who was on the base at Grafton Underwood when you got there? The 97th had used it originally.
They had gone, and it was...
92nd was there?
No, nobody was there. The Royal Air Force was the custodian of it in the transition.
Yeah.
So we started from scratch. We didn't have anybody to, no American groups were there to turn it over to us.
Do you remember the first 10 days of operations in June, where they lost 10 airplanes in the first 10 days, where it must have been it must have just closed down like a mantle over that field, the morale.
It was a very strenuous time, and even before that June mission, our squadron commanders and Beckett and others had gone down to fly with the 305th out of Chelveston. I don't know why they didn't fly with the combat wing groups, but Chelveston, LeMay was commanding at that time, and John DeLuca was deputy commander. I was a good friend of his. So our senior air officers would go down, and they flew their first missions with the 305th. That's where they got their baptism of fire.
Yeah.
But then when June came, and we were on our own, and our losses were relatively heavy, why, it was a strenuous thing.
Now, Peasley led the 41st Combat Wing on the mission to Swinford, the first one. That was August 17th, 1943.
Yeah.
J. General LeMay, or Colonel LeMay at that time, led the Regensburg part of that, and they got off in the morning.
They were a diversion.
They were a diversion. But instead of the group that was going to Swinefurt, they waited until the afternoon to get off. There was a great spread in time, so the German fighters had a chance to land and then come back up. And they were just hacked to pieces. That's where this book, The Right Place, The Wrong Place at the Wrong Time, talks about, is the guy who led the 305th, if you remember in there. They lost 15 airplanes that day, and one or two of them came back, including the major he writes about. The second Swinefurt raid was led by Tom Beckett.
I remember
And they
that.
Lost six airplanes, and that was a vicious raid. They were under fighter attacks for a long time.
A lot of aircraft damage.
That's right.
I didn't know the particulars of the what was going on at the time, but I one of my responsibilities was the engineering and aircraft maintenance and repair. So when we would have heavy battle damage like that, why...
Were you in charge of the engineering? You had all...
You mentioned I was executive officer. There were two executive officers. Air executive officer, which was Tom Beck.
Okay.
And ground executive officer. Now, you look at a table of organization of the Air Force
groups in those
days.
I've seen that table.
You'll never find ground executive officer.
Okay, all right. Now
this was something that was established during 1942 when these groups were being assembled here in the States. And I was one of the earlier ground executive officers. I had command of a satellite base up in Watertown, South Dakota. And they appointed me ground exec of the 384, which was then in training at Sioux City. And squadrons of the 384 and other groups would fly into Watertown to practice detached operations.
Did you then, that you've answered another question, I didn't know, and I have looked at that table of organization, I didn't know there was a ground executive officer.
That was me.
Did you or Beckett have charge of the engineering officers for each squadron? Fritz was an engineering officer for the 545th. Somebody else was an engineering officer for the 547th.
And we had a group engineering officer.
And he was under you then, right?
That's right. It was through, I had charge of everything except the flying operations.
Okay.
Beckett had charge of intelligence and S3, which was operations, and all flying operations.
All right. Let me ask you one other question now. Was there at any time that battle damage on airplanes was diminished so it would look better at wing? That's a question now. That's an important question for me.
You mean diminished? The reports were
The airplane would be, they would say, instead of real heavy battle damage, they might say slight battle damage.
And that's in reports.
In reports that I'm getting. I'm hunting up reports now on airplanes. My airplane came back from Swinefurt just shot to hell. I had the tail was hit by 20 millimeters, and the tail gunner was not wounded, but then there was 200 and some holes and the plaque in the engines, and the batteries were shot out. So I got the engineering reports for that day and expecting to see it. And it says in there slight flak damage. The damage I had was from fighters.
I have no knowledge of that. As a matter of fact,
that was not
my recollection is that the engineering report of those missions was incorporated in the overall mission report that went up to wing, and that went through operations, and I didn't knowledge.
There was no attempt to downplay battle damage for the benefit of wing.
Not to my knowledge. Okay. What would they gain by that?
I don't know, because it still has to be fixed.
Yeah.
It still has to be repaired, and it takes hours or man hours to repair that.
That's right.
But whether wing looked hooked down here and said, okay, now you've got to tighten things up, or you got to get your formations better so you don't get all this battle down. I don't know.
I hadn't heard of that accusation.
Now, I do know, and you've told me before, that you were in charge of one of the big jokes of the 384th, of all the reunions and the people that I talked to, is this mud on the roads and mud on the streets, which became a serious problem after Peasley left.
Well, in
and I understand that Smith's, a fellow named Jim Taft was directly in charge of that. Is that right?
Well, Smith held me personally responsible for the mud on the roads.
Yes. What did you do about it?
Well, I'll tell you, there's a certain amount of merit to that, because that reflects on morale. People tracking mud into the mess hall and their barracks and the operations area and everything else. So we worked with the, it wasn't the Royal Air Force, it was an engineering outfit of the British assigned to us, mostly Irish laborers, to shore up the roads. Put some hard top on them and shoulders on
them.
And
was
so forth.
What was causing it? Just
continual
mud running
rain.
Across the road, or
well, continual rain, and the trucks had no discipline. They'd go from a muddy parking area right up to the road, and the road would soon become a quagmire.
Well, did other bases have this same problem?
Yeah. Oh yes. Yeah.
I remember the latrines were these tin latrines with the open bottom and the open top, and those floors.
Yeah.
Were always
slippery.
Wet, always wet.
Yeah. And they were slippery.
Yes, they were.
Yeah.
That
yeah.
was one of the uncomfortable things
yeah.
about...
But because of discipline, and we did crack down on, for instance, truck drivers that would not park on hard surfaces, and bicycles would have to stay on hard surfaces. And we just made everybody conscious of it. And actually, it was resulted in a cleaner base after several months.
Yeah. So,
but it wasn't a big operational thing like Smith made.
The other question I have is, right, is now, after all these years, there's indications that Peasley was a heavy, heavy drinker.
False. Bud liked his nip, but I've never seen him drunk. And his occasions of taking more than one drink would be far removed from his flying activities. And he was never impaired when he was making decisions or, of course, in flying. He was not a party man.
He was highly respected. Highly
very much.
And I don't know whether...
Tom and... Peasley and I would go into Kettering when we had time off, and there was a British family in there. They seemed old at the time, but I guess they were 60s, and they kind of took us under their wing.
Oh, is that right?
And we would sneak some food into them, and they would let us relax.
Oh, great.
And, but the drinking we did there was a British beer, which was very weak, and that would never...
God, I remember that. I remember those hills more than anything else. There's one, the Swan Pub was a straight line into the hills and down those two hills and up.
Did you ride your bicycle to it?
I rode my bicycle, and my engineer broke his leg after he finished his missions the first time to town to celebrate.
Yeah.
His name was Jim Holland. He broke his leg and was over there 6 weeks longer than he would have been.
Speaking of bicycles, when we first got there, the British gave us, or we inherited, a number of British bicycles which had the caliper brakes. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I got one out
okay.
here.
The American... supply called for bicycles. There were a certain number of bicycles brought over. They're old, heavy, balloon tire, heavy ones, which proved to be impractical on the British roads and so forth. and pretty soon they were replaced by the British. But the casualty rate from bicycles on a given day were higher than the casualty rates of missions, because the fellows coming over were not used to the caliper brakes, and they'd go down these hills, hell-bent to election. They'd squeeze both hands and zip.
That's how Holland did it. The fantastic thing was is the number of bicycles. I lost one in Kettering one night, and I took another one and rode it out to the base, and the next morning I get on to go out to eat, and it's gone, you know. It was stolen. I'd stolen it, and somebody else stole it from me, and my own was stolen.
We tried to regulate.
When I left there, I think I paid $15 for a bike that I didn't have. I'd given it to somebody else.
We tried to regulate the ownership of bicycles, but it didn't work.
I don't know how you could do it. You'd go to the pub in Kettering, and there'd be 500 bikes
parked right
near there.
We did regulate the thievery of jeeps by removing the rotors every time we left the Jeep.
Yeah. Who was the Eskimo that was up there at the 545th that they had all the problems with? They had him in a tent out there all by himself.
God, I didn't know about that.
There was an Eskimo that they couldn't handle, and they put him in a tent. As you come up the road to the 545th and turned, there was a tent over there.
Yeah?
And I guess he was pretty well left alone and not given too many duties. And
Was he an enlisted man?
Yeah, enlisted man. Great big guy. And I just remember seeing him. I couldn't tell you his name. That may have happened
after leaving.
Yeah. I left. I got there. Let's see. You left at the end of June. I was there.
I left actually middle of June.
I was there.
I was in Russia at the end of June.
Yeah, that's. I was there, and I got there in late March. My first mission was in early April, and then I left about the 17th. About the 17th of August is when I finally left.
Mm-hmm.
But I did fly D-Day morning, and I was kind of proud of that. That's the only thing in my limited mind I thought that would be historical. I didn't realize that these great masses of airplanes, you know, 1,000 airplanes up there early in the morning.
Do you recall whether or before you took off that morning, looking up in the sky and see these gliders from that base over about five miles away?
But
and you looked at them and just knew damn well that 80% of them would never come back.
And I always thought to myself, and years later, I've talked to some of the pilots that come in here, why they didn't take those C-47 pilots and make them fly two or three missions.
Yes.
To see flak and to be shot at.
Yeah.
Get over that, because that first time, I went with Fioretti the first time, and he was so damn nervous he wouldn't let me touch nothing. Wouldn't let me pull the wheels up, wouldn't let me lock the tail wheel. I'm sitting there as a co-pilot, not really knowing what to expect, and here this guy is shaking. And the guy became a colonel. He had won the Silver Star, and I'm not putting him down. I'm just saying that he didn't want anybody but his own co-pilot in there touching anything. He wasn't going to let me kill him after he'd gone this far. He had 22 or 23 missions. The other thing was, there's a classic story, and Smith put it in his book about calling all the pilots together and raising hell with this one particular pilot about not being able to fly formation and his bombs being out of the pattern, and really raised hell with him, gave him all kinds of hell in front of the other pilots, gave the guy another mission, and in the course of it he says, somebody in the back of the room yelled out, or Smith said, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. And somebody else yells out, so's the road to heaven, or something, and it's embarrassing to Smith.
Hmm.
And he says in the book that he shouldn't have verbally given the guy hell in front of all these other people. He should have called him by himself. But that sounds like him.
Yeah.
And he cites examples where he thinks he did things wrong, but that didn't help the guys that he really got into trouble.
Yeah.
He would go up to these critiques, and I'll tell you one thing about these wing critiques. I don't know whether he ever went to one of them. But him and Travis would tear. I don't want to.
By the way, on the recording now, I was going to say I've made some disparaging remarks about him. Would this ever get back to him?
No.
Okay. All right.
No,
you're going to edit and so forth.
This will be confined right here to the...
Whatever, yeah.
390th Museum.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
I'm not out to castigate or to hurt Dale O. Smith. I've got other people who have made more disparaging remarks than you have, and I don't... This will all be edited.
Something here reminded me of a side story of the interstate that I was looking at. Oh, Geiger Field.
Yeah.
Now, this isn't worth recording.
Well, I want it all. Go ahead.
In 1941, I was base adjutant. This was before Pearl Harbor. I was base adjutant at Salt Lake City Air Base. And one of the Air Force, I think it was the 2nd Air Force, had the headquarters at Geiger Field. I saw Geiger Field on one of those. And there was a meeting called of base adjutants and base commanders and so forth at Geiger. And in order for me to get up to Geiger Field, I just asked our base operations officer to schedule me a flight. Well, this was in a B-16, which was the predecessor of the B-17. It was a two-engine, as I recall. The pilot was a Lieutenant Colonel LeMay that I'd never met before, but he had one of the groups there. It happened to be the 305th on the base. We flew from Salt Lake to Geiger Field over mountainous territory at altitudes varying from 100 to 200 feet. And I, of course, had not experienced very many flights at that time, because I just was called up to duty about 6 months before. But all of a sudden, I heard a sputtering of one of those two engines. And the co-pilot there had looked a little nervous to me and kept looking over at LeMay. And as soon as this sputtering of engine was heard or noticed, four hands went over to the fuel transfer gauge. And I wondered at the time, and I talked to the co-pilot afterwards, and he said LeMay was known for his getting the last drop of gas out of each tank before he would transfer it.
That must have been a little scary.
A little scary,
yeah.
To me.
Could you go through this Poltava thing again for the benefit of the 390th? How you got involved in that, or were you appointed by Smith to that?
No. You'll notice in one of these documents that I left here, Smith said that he was asked for a recommendation of, I suppose, all group commanders, of a senior officer, non-rated as he called it, to partake in a mission to Russia.
That's right. In that book he says non-rated. I remember that.
And so I was selected. Whether I was the finalist or the only one recommended, I don't know. But I didn't know anything about the so-called Russian mission. And I went to Air Force headquarters for a briefing and was told about the Eastern Command, as they called it. This was in the formative stages at that time. No, excuse me. It was operative at that time. It was a project involving three bases in Russia. These are former Russian air bases. Poltava was one, Mirograd was another, and Periatyn was the third. The idea was to have bomb, heavy bomb groups take off from England, fly past the point of no return, and bomb targets in what is was then Eastern Germany, and fly on to Russia to be rearmed and re-serviced, refueled. Take off from there to fly to bases, or to targets in southern Germany, Bavaria, land in Italy or North Africa, I never could recall where they did land, get rearmed, refueled, fly up to bases in western Germany and on to England. A shuttle mission involving three targets each mission.
And there was, they were going to do, were they going to keep that up? And there was some
They're going to keep it up indefinitely. Now, this
what was the politics that stopped it?
I didn't know about the politics until I heard on the, well, excuse me, I did do some reading afterwards, including this book of Parton's, which told me about the politics of it, where Stalin was dragging his feet, would not let us fly a supply mission, for instance, into Warsaw, and was very reluctant to even approve targets close to his lines because he wanted credit, apparently, for capturing the German armies in eastern Germany. So I didn't know anything about the diplomatic end of it.
When did you come out of Russia?
Excuse me. By September, it was decided we'd run out of targets. We were ordered to come back to England. A request was made for aerial transportation for about 900 men. After a lot of dickering around, we found that the transport was all required in the rapidly moving battleground in eastern France, and there was no planes available. So they laid on rail transport for us from Poltava, the ground echelons from Mirograd and Periodin all come into Poltava. We ended up with 900 enlisted men and 100 officers to go by train down through the Crimean Peninsula into northern Persia, Tabriz, northern Persia. It was not Iraq, Iran at that time. Well, it's a long story, but the Russian trains left something to be desired. They were cattle cars, actually, freight cars. It took us 2 days, roughly 2 days, to get down to there. And at Tabriz, we were met by a convoy of 10-ton diesel Mack trucks from Aden, A-D-E-N, down on the one of the seas down there. They had been engaged into trucking supplies up through Persia, up into Russia. So we caught this convoy and took off down to Tehran, Baghdad, Saudi Arabian Desert, Jerusalem, Cairo, and we boarded a British battleship, or some British warship, at Alexandria, and went through the Mediterranean back up to England. 900 men and 100 officers.
Later on about,
I didn't lose a man.
Is that right? How about their records?
And records
did,
were...
Did you pay them on the way, too?
No.
No, I know.
No, because... Let me give you a sidelight of that. We got we camped near Jerusalem. We were camping out all the time. This was a British base near Jerusalem. We decided to spend an extra couple days, and I let them choose whether they wanted to go to Tel Aviv or Jerusalem. I took the convoy that went into Jerusalem. We had about 10 trucks into Jerusalem. I'd never been there. I had no idea what it was. Jerusalem is a town of streets a little wider than a truck. You can imagine 10 trucks going in there, not knowing where they're going, and pretty soon we just stopped. And we hired some guides to take us through the religious sites. And I didn't know what to do, but I didn't know anything about trucks, but we had a hell of a good transportation sergeant who was in charge of the trucks. And I left him and I said, "Sergeant, we're going to leave at 3 o'clock this afternoon, get these trucks turned around, headed backwards, and we'll see you at 3 o'clock. We came back at 3 o'clock after having toured the city. We boarded the trucks, we started out, and a bunch of Jewish merchants started running after the trucks. And I was in a Jeep at the front of them. And so I stopped and through an interpreter and found out what's wrong. They said, "These new American $20 bills, what do we do with them?" And I looked at them. These were Russian rubles that my boys had exchanged for souvenirs and told them they're American dollar bills. They're Russian rubles. They weren't worth piss, even in Russia. And here they were.
They bought everything. What'd you tell them?
I boarded the truck and said, "Forward, hop over." As far as I know, there's still some Russian rubles floating
still
around.
Still trying to trade them in, that's
okay.
Good.
Well, anyway.
How did you get the 384th over there at Istres, and did they appreciate that?
Over to what?
Didn't you have a hand in getting the 384th over to Istres?
That's
France?
Down near Marseille.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't know the remember the name.
Yeah, Istres, France. Yeah.
That's another story. When I got back to England,
did they appreciate that when you did that?
I didn't know. I didn't go up and find out whether they appreciated.
Okay.
But I know they didn't.
Yeah.
Because I've talked to them since then.
Yeah.
But basically, what happened? I was director of organization at 8th Air Force after I got back from Russia. The Japanese war was still going on. We were ordered to take the highest, you remember the point system that we had? The highest points and form an army of occupation down in Marseille area. The lower points that hadn't been over there long enough to accumulate service points were to be flown to the Japanese theater. The higher points stayed at the safe place of Marseille, the army of occupation. It worked just the reverse. By the time they got there, the atom bomb had dropped. The groups that had the lowest point were flown back to the States, given their discharge.
Yeah, the old timers are still.
And the old timers were stuck at Marseille.
Well.
But we did it according to the book.
That's the way things usually work.
Yeah.
Yeah. Are you going to the reunion this next year in St. Louis, do you think?
As I mentioned, I'd like to get to a reunion, although the number of fellows I know...
There's still surprisingly a lot of them there. A lot of the...
Yeah.
I was surprised this year. I try to look up the original, the crews that went over there originally. I've got the orders for the original group that went over. And I found Armstrong last year, and Vanderhagen, and Warlow, and of course, they think their time was the toughest, and I think my time was the toughest, and the guys that finished up think their time was the toughest. Really doesn't make any difference. We were all in the same boat.
I was standing on the control tower when the first air echelon came in from the States. This was in 1943.
May of 43 was when it came in.
They came in kind of staggered. They'd come in through, I guess, Iceland, Scotland, or something. And one of the first planes asked for the commanding officer of the base. Well, Paisley hadn't landed yet, and I was senior officer. So this fellow, some guy from a wing or group or Air Force or something, handed me a bunch of papers and said, sign here. And I was worried about putting up all of these crews because the ground echelon hadn't reached there yet.
Yeah.
So I said, where do I sign? I signed about 18 or 36 papers.
Bought all them airplanes.
And I, when I finally finished, I said, what did I sign for? Well, these are accountability papers for these 36 airplanes that are coming in here. I said, my God, you mean, I didn't know how many millions of dollars this was.
Yeah.
I said, what do I do about it? He said, you're stuck with them now. And do you know, to the day I left Grafton Underwood, I don't know what the accountability of those original 36 planes were. They were written off on reports of survey, or some of them were still flying, but I lost track of them.
You never did get them signed up?
I never got them signed up. That was the least of my worries.
How'd you get away from the base? Didn't you have to go around and...
I was the ground exec.
Oh, okay, I was in charge. All right.
I made my own clearance.
Somebody else's owned them after you left there.
And you know, I never even thought of it until after the war that I'd signed for those things.
We signed for each one as we went over.
Yeah. It was
$195,000. I had that paper for years and years and years. But it was when it was taken away from you in Prestwick.
Yeah.
It was signed by, you were relieved of it.
Yeah. Well, that was there least was
a,
of my
I always
worries.
Thought about that, an old farm boy that $5,000 was a lot of money. Go over there and sign for a $195,000 airplane.
Yeah, well, you can imagine the job I would have had if they'd have demanded accountability for 36 times 195.
Well, you sure opened a window into the 384th. That a lot of just the flying people just don't realize it.
Yeah.
All of the work that went into keeping that base running,
In
the back of my mind all my life has been that crew chief out there in that tent.
Yeah.
Regardless of whether cold or hot or rainy, that damn coffee pot was going and those guys would be out there in that tent. The only time they had to themselves was when that airplane went on a mission. Then they're standing out there when you get back, sweating the fact that airplane's going to come back. Don't know how much work. Well, the day I turned that airplane over to that crew chief and he walked around with me, you could just see his dauber sink because, man, there's a lot of work there. I don't know whether he repaired those elevators or whether he took them off and sent them somewhere and then put them back on. An engine was wrecked. He had to take that off, and even if he got another engine, he had to put it on.
Yeah.
It was his responsibility, and those guys never got credit for that. I don't know whether they ever got medals for it.
Well, back of them were people you never even think of, military police.
That's true, yeah.
The anti-aircraft gunners.
Yeah.
The morning of D-Day, Smith says, how about our base protection? I guess it's brought out in his book. I says, Colonel, we've got gunners out there that have never fired a gun in anger. Well, let's go out and see. I said, Colonel, we've got to make sure they know we're coming ahead of because they're nervous as we are.
Do you remember Colonel Thacker?
Oh, yes, Bob Thacker. Yeah.
Do you remember the time that he put the deal on that the combat crews had to go down and stand guard at night? Remember that? That order?
Oh.
And They shot at him one morning and had him pinned down on the road down there. Then the order was taken off. It didn't last very long.
Well, speaking of that, one of the things that Smith did not mention, which I thought was one of the worst.
Okay.
This was fairly early in the war. Smith decided that in order for his staff officers to really appreciate what the combat crews were going through, he was going to have them fly on a mission.
I remember that.
Do you remember that?
Yeah.
One of the missions...
My good friend was killed that day.
One of the missions was a safe mission, quote...
Cherbourg.
So, the base inspector... One of the supply officers.
Do you remember their names?
He had a mustache. Not an elderly fellow in his 30s.
There were three of them lost that day.
Yeah. Three of my staff, because Smith decided that they should get that.
Never did it again after that.
Never did it again after
but
that.
One of the planes, that there was three airplanes lost that
day. Quote.
Cherbourg.
So, the base inspector one of the supply officers.
Do you remember their names?
He had a mustache. Not an elderly fellow in his 30s.
There were three of them lost that day.
Yeah. Three of my staff, because Smith decided that they should get that.
Never did it again after that.
Never did it again after
but
that.
But one of the planes, there was three airplanes lost that day, and one of the planes that went down was Brown, J.W. Brown. I'd gone all through flight school with him, and he came in there new, and I went over and talked to him and told him some of the things to expect, and he had flown his two or three missions initially. And went over there to Cherbourg on a simple little deal, and they knocked three airplanes down with flak. And I remember that day that there was three ground officers, and they never asked them to do that again. But I never have been able to get their names.
I don't know.
Date of that mission, and matter of fact, now that you've brought that up, I think I'll send to the National Archives and get that damn mission and get the names of those guys, because they'll be on the crew list. You know?
Yeah.
That's a good idea.
Yeah.
But, you know... That's vivid in my memory. I remember that mission.
I don't recall any other groups, hearing of any other groups trying that, so that must have been a personal decision of Smith alone.
I don't know whether it was or not, but I know it backfired on him.
And
you're right, that's not in this book.
No.
General Lyle came down here and sat and talked to me for an hour. Lyle had a personal opinion of Travis, having served under him for a long time. And of course, Colonel Bill Travis didn't have a good reputation with the flight crews. They didn't like to fly behind. They didn't like to fly behind Travis, because Travis would, on that, I think it was, it's this January the 11th, 1944 mission to Stuttgart, where he had circled the target four times. He went in by himself with the 384th and the 303rd and the 379th, circled the target three times, and then turned around and tried to bomb. They lost a bunch of airplanes. I think that was January the 11th, and they got the whole 8th Air Force got the congressional citation that day. What do you call it? The
presidential
citation.
I could never figure out why I was entitled to wear that.
Your group got it. The whole group got it.
The whole group got it, yeah. But I thought it should be the boys.
Have you sent in for your medals? It'll probably surprise you what you were awarded. You can get them at the...
Oh, I got my 201 file. I really haven't looked at it that close. Among
after
other
the
things,
war was over, you got it, or you had it?
I had copies of everything. That I just kept copies as I was going along.
Yeah. Well, you can get a record of your awards.
Yeah. Do you know one award that we got? No. This was when I was with the 8th Air Force headquarters. De Gaulle decided that the 8th Air Force was doing was saving France.
Croix-de-Guerre?
Croix-de-Guerre.
So. You're kidding. Did you get that?
He gave the, I was G5.
Damn, if the 8th Air Force got it, why didn't we get it?
Well, it didn't go down that far.
That's
but,
good. Well, you've got all those theaters that you were in. You've got all,
oh,
you've got
yeah.
ribbons for all those.
I don't even know whether we had an Eastern Command ribbon.
Probably did.
Maybe
did you
so.
Get anything from Russia?
That's what I meant.
Oh, I mean, did you get a Russian ribbon?
No, probably not. I don't think we did. I don't think we did.
These, the people here that flew on those shuttle missions are extremely proud of them, and it's a
yeah.
proud time
yeah.
for the 390th. I don't understand why the only the 3rd Division did it. Why didn't the 1st Division do it?
I don't remember the names of the groups.
It was all 3rd Division.
Was it?
Was
yeah.
No,
yeah.
There was no 1st Division
yeah.
groups
I
at all
know,
that went to Russia.
I don't know why.
They made 3 total, and the 390th was on 2 of them.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the Dutch drops, the food drops on Holland, May the 1st, 1945, were all 3rd Division.
Uh-huh.
And I always attributed that to LeMay. LeMay was the commanding officer of the 3rd
yeah.
Division at the end, I believe.
Yeah.
And before he went to, when did Doolittle go to Japan? LeMay had probably gone to Japan. Because he was, he stripped those 29s down. I don't know whether he went before the war ended in Europe or after the war ended in Europe.
I don't know. I never heard anything about it.
I just visited Offutt
yeah.
Field in...
Well, the reason I knew him afterwards, I kept in the reserves for a while and had a mobilization assignment at Offutt
yeah.
at Headquarters Strategic Air Command. And LeMay was in command down there at that time.
I know it. I just visited there after
yeah.
all these years. What is
yeah.
it, 50 years?
Yeah.
And God, he's still king.
Yeah.
He is still king.
Oh,
They've
yeah.
got all the pictures of the guys that have been there since he was, but his is the prominent one. They've got his all of his paraphernalias there.
Yeah.
And
he had the 305th down to Chelfast in the early part of the war. And I drove down there to talk to the other ground exec on some matter, and I stayed overnight. And we were sitting around, we had those all kind of converted Nissen huts.
Yeah.
And LeMay was sitting there reading. They had a fire going in a, I guess it was a fireplace or a converted potbelly stove or something. Anyway, the wall caught fire. And somebody came running in and says, "General, the wall's on fire." And LeMay looked up from his book and said, "So it is. Put it out." And went on reading.
You know, he did some pretty fantastic things. One is he, I don't know whether somebody else would have come along and done it, but he developed that combat box.
Yeah.
Then he put us to where we were bombing on one bombardier. And the
toggling.
Other, yeah, the other way was a nightmare trying to get all those airplanes over that target. We'd have had losses that would never have
yeah.
quit. He, I understand he was a hell of a navigator in his own right. You know, he had set navigation records. And, so he wasn't no dumbbell.
Yeah.
But I always thought he kind of went overboard a little bit on, he had a lot of people disliking him inside. But I don't think they're there for popularity,
Speaking
I guess.
Speaking of all-time officers, when I was called up to active duty in June of 41, before Pearl Harbor, commanding officer there at Salt Lake Air Base was a Colonel Lowell Smith. Well, Lowell Smith was one of the four, flew one of the four planes that went around the world in 1922.
Right?
And he later then commanded Davis-Monthan Air Base
yeah.
during the war
yeah.
sometime. And he was one of the original flyers.
Were you at Wing or, let's see, you were still in, you were not, did your friend that was with Aker ever give you any of Akers' reaction to Doolittle coming in there? Is that in there?
No, this is Poltava only.
Oh, okay.
But it's a book that you will be able to trace down.
Well, we probably got it here.
This is the title page of
it. All right.
And no, I didn't know Parton himself.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. In fact, I don't think I ever met Akers.
That was quite.
Spots was command of. They called it USTAF. U.S.
Yes, yes, I remember.
So
he was. That's after Doolittle got there, though, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Because Spots was in the Mediterranean.
That's right, and come up. I think Spots was in Versailles when
Doolittle come up there, as I understand it, because Eisenhower wanted him. He was more aggressive than. Than Aker, but Aker took that hard.
Well, see, Doolittle come up to what they call Pine Tree.
Yes.
That was at High Wycombe. That was headquarters 8th Air Force. And Spots had the European Air Force over at Versailles.
Okay.
And two Spots, yeah.
Well, you had a pretty varied career.
Oh, yeah.
And it must have been pretty interesting, especially that Russian. Zemke served some time in Russia before the war.
Oh, yeah.
And there's quite an article in his book about the time he spent in Russia. Yeah. Their thoughts and ideas and everything were totally different than ours. And I've heard that the reason we didn't keep flying those missions is that Stalin finally didn't want that many
Well, there's quite a bit about that in this excerpt here.
That's good.
About the inner workings of it. And, of course, down at Poltava, we didn't know a damn thing of what was going on. All we were worried about was to service the planes that were coming in and keep going and trying to keep our guys from screwing the Russian women. And although we had limited contact with the civilian pos.
Well, they had a lot of women in the military, though, didn't they?
Not at our base.
Oh, okay.
They had a, I guess you'd call it an engineer detachment at the base, mostly women. They're the ones that went out and tried to fight the fires with sand buckets.
What'd they do with all those burned up B-17s? Just scrape them up and...
We had a big salvage yard. There were 37 planes, I remember, that we had to scrap. And we took off, if I recall, I wasn't in the engineering end of it. I was headquarters commandant. So that's another thing you'll never find on a TO, headquarters commandant. I got there, and they say, "You're headquarters commandant."
Did you give yourself that name?
I said, "What is it?" And this Bob Cullen, he's later quite a noted fire over there. He said, "I don't know what it is, but you're in charge of everything except flying."
What was the name? Headquarters Commandant.
Headquarters Commandant.
That's a pretty good title.
It's a French word.
Well, I'm not going to hold you up any longer.
Well, I appreciate this.
Really, given me a great day.
This enabled me to dredge up some old memories that...
I may call on you from time to time with a letter or something, and anything I hear, I'll let you know. I'll send you...
You mentioned a couple of these books. I'd like to borrow... there was one you...
You want Peasley's book.
Well, do you have Peasley's
book? I'll look that up and loan it to you,
And what other book?
Yeah, I've got The Screaming Eagle here.
I've read The Screaming Eagle.
And then As Briefed, which is our regular...
As Briefed.
That's our group book.
Yeah, you know, I can't find my copy of that.
Well, do you want to look that over?
Let me look this
over,
and
take
I'll
it with
get
you.
It back to
take
you
it with you.
Within the couple weeks.
All right.
And,
don't hurry. Don't worry about it. I'll look up Peasley's book. I've got it.
But you mentioned another one about a certain...
The right place at the wrong time?
Yeah, I don't have I'll a just recollection
put that,
of that.
I'll just put that... That's not our group. That's the 305th group that's writing that.
Okay, that's...
And I'll drop that in the mail to you, and you can read it. and then just return it. It's
why don't you just
It's got a lot of people in there that you know, particularly Peasley and Milton. And
Are you leaving your connection here with the 309?
First of the year. Yeah, the first of the year. However, anything for me can come down here and they'll hold it for me.
Well, of course, I'll see that you get this back before
I've got a mailbox and here.
Yeah.
And I want to, I'm 75 now, Jim, and I want to...
Well, I'm 80.
I know.
Now, do you want to go through this?
Yes, I'd love to, and I will return
that. Well, keep that, and go through whatever you want.
All right. And this picture I'd like to have, I want to copy that.
Well, that'll go with that stuff there, yeah.
And any pictures you've got that I could take, okay, you've got these, I can have these.
I think I've called out.
Have these copied. And
I think I've called out here everything dealing with the
384. Okay, good.
And including some newspaper articles and so forth.
Then I'll just leave this the way it is and return it.
I'll someday I've got to put that in a scrapbook. I've got a teenage grandson that is... really interested in Air Force, and he poured through all of that.
Yeah, I've got a. That's what I'm doing mine for. Although the more I get into this stuff, the more interesting it becomes. Some stuff that was right under your nose, you didn't realize, you know. And just as a flying officer, you're not privy to the what's going on at headquarters. And the politics of the base and. Plus the problems of feeding everybody and getting them housed and taking care of their health. My God, what a fantastic operation those things are. These bases, normally this base had about 7,000 people go through it. And I would imagine the 384th being there at about the same time had about the same number. We don't get the turnouts at the reunions that the 390th does, but there's no other group in the world that has a museum like this 390th has either.
What is the closest to this that the 384th has?
Well, the 384th has a historian up in up here in Sholo. His name is Orion. He was a POW. He's put together this thing here, which shows all the missions and the planes that were shot down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's where I've already knew that your losses. See, this is the first, second, third, and the fourth mission. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
Yeah.
10 people down. That's tremendous.
Yeah.
And it never got that bad again till Swineford and the Swineford April 13th. And over Poffenhoffen, see, this is the 13th of April, we lost 9. Then on the 24th of April, we lost 7. That's 16 in 2 weeks, see? And he goes into great detail on this mission, but fluffs this one off.
Yeah.
This is after he's built him up and got our morale way up in the air. He's General Savage.
Yeah.
And I have a friend who does a lot of writing, and if you can understand his writing, I'll send you some of it. Compares Smith to Savage. He calls Smith General Savage of the 12 o'clock high. See, General Savage goes in to save the group.
McMillan was lost. Does he come to these reunions?
No, I don't know whether he's still alive or not.
That's what I was wondering.
He was a big contractor down in Texas.
After the war?
Yeah.
Is that right?
Paving contractor.
Oh,
And I think he's still alive. Antwerp, Belgium. Disney and Oblinsky went down, and then McMillan went down on the second mission to Hamburg.
Second mission, then.
Selden L. McMillan, He had one killed and 9 prisoners.
Yeah.
And I can find out if he's still alive.
No, I wasn't that close to him because...
one guy told me that Kettleson, when he came to the group... And he was one of the originals.
Yeah, he was with us over.
He wore those Jodhpurs and the boots.
Yeah,
and carried a swagger stick.
Yeah,
and there's some. I'm not going to repeat the stories that I've heard about him, but not good.
Yeah,
and I've got a Frenchman now who's writing a book on the September the 16th, 1943 mission, where they dropped the bombs. They went over there to bomb a ship at Brest, or Nantes, N-A-N-T-E-S,
yeah,
which is on the board, on the shore. Lorient and Saint-Nazaire was down there, and he supposedly went wild on the bomb run, and they dropped their bombs on the civilian population, killed 800 civilians. That boy's daddy was a little kid and was in one of the apartment houses. He wasn't killed, he wasn't hurt, but he never got over the bombs dropping onto that apartment house.
Yeah.
He imparted this to this kid who's now an engineer, and he travels a lot in the United States. And I put him onto a lot of the ways to find out the through the National Archives. He's gotten all the records on that, and he's pinpointed the airplanes that the bombs came out of. He's got all the bomb sites located on the ground.
Yeah.
And he's going to write a book, and I've now put him off onto to Kettleson.
Yeah.
And whether he will call Kettleson up and ask him a lot of this stuff or not, I don't know.
Yeah.
And maybe that's not fair when a man is older, but...
I think I told you, didn't I? Well, now, did you see Langlois at one of these recent...
Yeah, I've seen him twice. And
You know what his physical condition is.
He's got a lot of problems.
Yeah.
And that's too bad, because he was a nice... He was a nice guy. He didn't come to this last one, I don't believe.
I don't think he did.
But I saw another friend of mine, Jack Liebert, who was a pilot there and flew 30 missions, 35 missions, has a brain tumor now. And I wrote to him and never got an answer, and I've written again, never got an answer. His speech is stumbling, and he's on a cane, and that's kind of depressing. But you also go and you see some of these old guys drinking just like they did 50 years ago. Jim? This is from headquarters, AAF station number 106, office of the station commander, APO 634, 26th of August 1943. Subject is a commendation to Major James A. Taft, TAF, capital T-A-F-F, Headquarters Detachment, 384th Bombardment Group H, AAF. Number one, I take great pleasure in being able to commend you for your exceptional performance of duty during the past few months of operations. Had it not been for your industrious efforts, our success could not have been obtained in such a high degree. It is my desire that you know that your contribution to these successes is acknowledged and has a definite and direct bearing on eventual victory. You have experienced long, tedious hours of duty under tension and have been proven. I know that you will continue your fine work until the job is completed and the ultimate victory is ours. Bud J. Peasley, Colonel in the Air Force, commanding. This is out of Bob's file. It's an engraved invitation saying, quotes, the commanding officer and the members of the 384th Bombardment Group, USAAF, request your company at their 100th Mission Festival, Monday the 15th of May, 1944, at 8:30 p.m. And I was there, unquotes. This is a letter from Colonel Dale O. Smith, quotes, 384th Bombardment Group H, U.S. Army Air Forces, Office of the Group Commander, APO 557, 24 July 1944, to whom it may concern. Lieutenant Colonel James A. Taft has been assigned to the 384th Bombardment Group Heavy as its executive officer since the group's activation January 1, 1943. He arrived in the ETO with the group in June 1943 and was instrumental in establishing a good station for the operation of the 384th Bomb Group. The fine record of the group and the superior standards maintained by the station, including messes, transportation, runways, roads, and other base services, speak highly for the ability of Colonel Taft. I assumed command in November 1943, and Colonel Taft acted as executive until his transfer in July of 1944. Throughout that period, many widespread improvements in base service have been initiated and executed by Colonel Taft. His work was always marked with enthusiastic enthusiasm, imagination, justice, and sound executive judgment. I do not hesitate in recommending Colonel Taft for any ground executive position available in the Air Forces. Colonel Dale O. Smith, Colonel Air Corps Commanding. The men who keep them flying. James A. Taft, Lieutenant Colonel Air Corps. Quotes, as executive officer of this group since the beginning of its operations, I have had the pleasure of supervising and closely observing the activities of the men on the ground, the men who literally keep them flying. It is believed that the typical conception of the men who are responsible for keeping them flying is restricted to the men actually working on the aircraft. The various technical specialties and airplane and engine mechanics. Often, no thought is given to the hundreds of men whose work is of equal importance and without whose efforts the operational missions could not be successfully accomplished. These include the clerks, cooks, medics, sheet metal workers, drivers, armorers, ordnance workers, telephone operators, photographers, just to mention a few. Most of the glory and plaudits earned in aerial warfare have gone to combat personnel. Medals, citations, and other honors have been heaped upon them, and rightfully so. Theirs is the dangerous task, and they partake in the final accomplishment of the mission, the dropping of bombs on the selected target. But not a single one of them would fail to share these honors with the men on the ground were he able to do so. They realize the consequence of the faulty engine, a radio that fails, or a gun that jams at a critical moment. They are well aware of the fact that their very lives are dependent upon the work done by those left behind, and they seldom fail to show their appreciation for the efforts of these men. A close unity, a brotherhood born out of mutual respect, is essential to any operational group such as ours. Our tempo of operations has steadily increased since that day in February 1944, when the all-out offensive directed at strategic targets in continental Europe were started in earnest. We began flying more planes to more distant targets and than had ever been attempted before. The effect of this increased scale of operations, not noticeable to some extent on combat crews, but much more on ground personnel. There was a definite reason for this. Even during our period of heaviest losses, the replacement crews had continued to flow in regularly. Our operations were seldom hampered by a lack of sufficient number of combat personnel. Although they were flying more missions per month than they formerly did and flying more hours per mission, the pace was not unbearable and was interrupted at more or less frequent intervals by passes and leaves at rest homes. In addition, there existed what I believe to be the most important factor in the psychological strain they were required to undergo. They had a definite goal to aim for, the completion of their operational tour in this theater. A certain number of missions, which has since been increased several times, was set as a standard. When a man had participated in the required number of sorties, he became eligible for assignment to non-combat duties within the group or for release, which usually meant return to the zone of the interior. Ground personnel had no such incentives. Passes and furloughs for them were things of the past. There was no such thing as completion of a tour for them. They had to be here as long as the war in this theater lasted, and they knew it. Accepting their plight, they resigned themselves to it and proceeded to perform the most outstanding work ever witnessed by this theater. The number of combat crews has doubled, and the number of aircraft increased by over 50%. All services, housing, feeding, supply, transportation, aircraft maintenance, had to be provided without any increase in the strength of the ground personnel. In fact, their number was decreased through normal attrition. A large number of skilled technicians were released to newer units in the theater in order to equalize experience levels, and a few were returned to the zone of the interior to provide the nucleus for units being formed there. Consequently, every man had to buckle down and do the work of two men. This they did, and did it without complaint. Morale was excellent, and the disciplinary rate was even less than that among combat personnel. Morale among these men was kept at a high level because of their constant insistence that they be fully informed on just what was going on. Whenever possible, strike photos, especially successful ones, were displayed to them immediately after a mission. Tanny, parentheses, loudspeaker, in parentheses, talks were frequently given by the commanding officer, outlining the high points of the day's mission, describing in detail and commending those men for their efforts. Mock briefings were held covering actual targets previously attacked. A limited number of men were permitted to participate in operational missions. Section heads and organization commanders, from the group commander on down, made frequent informal tours through all sections. Visits, not inspections, but by far the most important factor was the close relationship cultivated between the combat and the ground personnel. Segregation and distinction were avoided whenever possible. Living conditions in the European theater of operations were better than most of us had expected. As a rule, each base is large enough to hold the bombardment group and all of its service units, such as sub-depot, station complement, ordnance, quartermaster, chemical, finance, weather, and so forth. Minor difficulties arose on those stations built according to British standards. Many alterations had to be made because of differences in strength, manners of living, and methods of operation. Typical Yankee ingenuity accomplished most of these changes without a minimum of trouble. More difficulty was encountered in housing and feeding. The increased number of combat crews assigned during that period. It was necessary for certain units to go under tents. Messes were consolidated as much as possible. The quality and quantity of food were uniformly good. Post-exchange items, although strictly rationed, were adequate. One of the contributing factors to our high state of morale was the excellent work accomplished by our special services section. Our guiding thought was to provide enough facilities for recreation and entertainment on the base so that men could stay home as much as possible. We did not fear Anglo-American disputes. Indeed, close friendships developed between our men and the inhabitants of neighboring villages. But towns around here were greatly overcrowded and civilian rations were short. With this in mind, the buildings were converted into a fine theater with 35 films each night. Baseball, volleyball, football fields were constructed and clubs opened up for both officers and non-commissioned officers. In addition to the club, aerial club established by the American Red Cross, educational programs were established, including foreign language classes, army talks, and daily newscasts. Dances were held periodically by all organizations to which were invited young women, both civilian and military, from neighboring communities. An amateur show was started as a sideline, but turned out to be so good that it was a runner-up in the 8th Air Force contest and played in several surrounding towns before British audiences. We are continually on the lookout for more ways in which we can keep the men's minds off their work during off-duty hours, and it has paid dividends, judging from the quality of work they have been able to perform under adverse conditions. Normal duty hours mean nothing for these men, and also, and sleep is a precious item to be snatched at any time when the opportunity affords. Most of our missions, especially when we ran two in one day, were scheduled for a dawn takeoff. This meant that during the early hours of the previous evening, the ordnance and armament workers started to load all aircraft, working through the night until a short time before the crews were routed out of bed for breakfast. In the meantime, crew chiefs and their assistants were going over the plane in detail, making sure that everything was shipshape for the coming mission. Oftentimes, major repairs were affected during this period. While this was going on, servicing crews were busy filling the aircraft with gasoline and oxygen. After takeoff, some of the these men would have occasion to sneak in a few hours of sleep, but most of the had other work to do. Aircraft held on the ground had to be put in shape and so forth. Occasionally, work at night was interrupted momentarily by a red alert, enemy aircraft in the vicinity. Lights were extinguished as much as possible, but the work still went on. At the time of this writing, we are engaged in a period of even more tense activity than during the past few months. D-Day has arrived and passed, and our operational work has increased again. But now the boys have a gleam in their eye. This is it. We are on our way to deliver the final knockout punch. Work may be hard, but physical fatigue and strain is forgotten, and we can begin to see the results of the past month's efforts. We now think someday the lights will go on again in this, and the strain will be over. Reams have been written about the honors and glories of the boys who fly. But let us remember the work of the boys who stay on the ground so that others can fly. Theirs is the thankless task, but they go on working just the same. All are fighting for the same goal, and the work of all is equal importance. That's end quote. That's finished. The 384th Bombardment Group, parentheses heavy, end parentheses, formerly of the 8th Air Force, comprised of the 544th, 545th, 546th, 547th Bombardment Squadrons, 443rd Sub Depot, 1140th Military Police Company, 854th Chemical Company, the 1119th Quartermaster Company, the 33rd Station Complement, the 203rd Finance Section, the 2023rd Firefighting Platoon, the 1774th Ordnance Company, and a detachment of the 18th Weather Squadron spent 23 months in combat during World War II in the European Theater of Operations, commencing with the first mission on June the 22nd, 1943. The group flew 316 credited combat missions with 9,348 credited sorties. They lost 159 B-17s and a total of 1,625 men, of which 1,579 aircrew members were lost on combat missions. The group was credited with destroying 165 enemy aircraft with 34 more probables and damaging 116. 22,415 tons of bombs were dropped on enemy targets. The group had the distinction of dropping the last bombs carried by the 8th Air Force on April the 25th, 1945.